We are recording now. Okay, here we go. The reading for today is Position 1, the Priestess. How appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Position 2, Three of Discs, Works. Position 3 is Five of Discs, Worry.
Joy has arrived.
Hey, Joy.
Hey, Johanna. How's it going?
Okay, we're going through the cards here. And position 4 is Six of Swords, Science. Let me repeat that. The first card is the Priestess. The second card is Works. The third card is a Five of Discs, Worry. And the sixth card is a Six of Swords, Science.
Okay.
Fifth card is Nine of Wands, Strength. The outcome, or the sixth card, future outcome, is 10 of Discs, Wealth.
Wow, that's a disc.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Arc of Influence, the Magus.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Which one is it, by the way, Johanna? Do you have?
I only have the one.
Okay.
The one that looks like Hermes.
Yeah.
And that's the one I have, and I only have this one, Hermes with the caduceus in the back.
Okay.
Right. Okay. It looks like he's a car ornament. Okay. Sorry about that, Hermie.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like Mercury.
Yeah, Mercury, right, exactly. The six of, that's the seventh card. The eighth card is Pleasure, the Six of Cups. Pleasure has come up a few times.
Yeah.
In the readings. I mean, this is very interesting.
Well, both the Six of Cups and Six of Swords were in last week's reading, weren't
they? Yeah. And then the final one is Fortune, the Wheel.
Mm.
Okay, everyone's got that?
I have a question, and this is something I should know by now. The elements associated with the first four cards, I know Earth is associated with number 4, but what is the order of the other
elements? Okay, the first card is Fire.
Okay.
That's the Priestess. Uh-huh. Water is the second card.
Okay.
Which is Works. The third card is Air. It's Yod, He, Vav, He. As in the Hebrew, as reading the Hebrew from right to left.
Okay.
So what we're missing is wands.
No, we have wands.
So we have at least one of each suit.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, but otherwise the predominance of discs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Interesting. Before we get started, I have a question, and of course, we have an expert with us that can answer this question immediately. What is the meaning of the caduceus? In other words, the staff in magic. What work does it do?
Oh, the magical. Are you asking me? Who are you asking?
Whoever. Well, yeah.
The magical staff.
People have wands. A lot of people think wands and staff.
No, they're not. They're not. I have.
So the question I have is what is, what does the staff do?
Now,
I have my answer, which may or may not be relevant, but I thought I would, get the expert's word first.
If I recall, I am not an ex, please don't ever, oh, please, I mean,
Well, we know you have a huge basement with...
With magical implements. No, I don't.
A magical circle engraved on the...
No, I wish, please. I told my husband I was making...
Can't hear the tortured victim.
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait.
I have a very funny story about that. My extra bedroom, I wanted to make a magical room, right? And my husband looked at me like I was crazy. I would have to paint the walls indigo, deep indigo, put lights of the four elements in each corner, proper corner. It was really funny. And when he heard Lady Sarah tell what had to be done, he goes over, "Are you crazy?" Well, number one, the magical staff, I think, only comes...
That was obviously early in the marriage.
Yes, very early in the marriage. But now it's a... Yeah, he took over. It's one of his junk rooms. He goes, "Oh, I can't wait." He says, "When I pass on, I want to see what this house turns out to look like." And I says, "It's all mine." Okay, now, here we go. The magical staff comes about in a certain aspect of initiation. It's not there for a neophyte. Okay? It is when you get up to Zelator or one of those standards or Magus that you have, that you are given your magical staff.
When I think of Zelator, I always think of some...
Zelator. Is that how you pronounce it? Zelator? Okay.
I don't... Crazy fanatic, you know, passing up political pamphlets on the corner.
Yeah. Or Hare Krishna, you know, one of the...
Mm-hmm. So it's really a stage of it's given as a tool in a certain stage of magical development. And it means that you could conduct a ritual. That's what I recall right now without opening up my Golden Dawn.
Okay.
Which
may
be why
Disney
Sorcerer's Apprentice had a problem with the broomstick.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, my view is a little more generic. I don't claim that it's based on Golden Dawn tradition, so it could be. The difference between the staff and the wand, or the wand is for both evoking desire, but it's also for directing desire. Whereas the staff comes when you are interested in unifying the worlds and transcending them. So in other words, the staff essentially is the tree of life or the magical implement of Adam Kadmon. And so that, and here we're going to have Mick and Mike, which represents microcosm and macrocosm.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that the staff represents as a caduceus is known as the Guna brothers. That's out of Theosophy. The Guna brothers are, of course, Sattva, which is the core of the staff, the central column, which notice doesn't have a voice in this thing, and it's quiet, and only Mick and Mac talk. And Mick and Mac represent both Rajas, which is energy, expended energy, and Tamas, which is inertia. So you have inertia and energy, both of which sort of cancel each other out, sort of like matter and antimatter, which is another version of the macro and the micro. That they are, and the way they're separated so that they can actually function the way that, you know, sort of like the strong force and the weak force, if we want to start using the quantum mechanic views. They would cancel each other out completely if they weren't kept apart, and the way they're kept apart is through sattva, which is usually described as a balancing between them. But in magical works, it actually represents the complete human being, the true magus, who has the power over all the elements and unifies them. It's sort of like, it's a sort of an anthropic view. view of the world, meaning that the world is created for human beings, which I know is, if you're an environmentalist, might seem slightly questionable because of the way we act in our community. But, that's essentially how I understand the wand in its use in magic. So it's very, very different. For one
thing,
it unifies all the other elements. In other words, the other magical elements.
I have a magical wand from Israel Regarding.
No, I didn't mean wand.
You mean staff. Yeah, I know. Yeah, the staff also is the person who has the staff. They sort of pound on the floor to open the circle or close the circle. It's definitely a power tool of authority, and it's not to be used lightly.
Yeah, that's because it represents the unified or the connection of all the worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, like some of us think, you know, that we act in the world discreetly, which is more an accident of our focus than the truth of what we actually do. And this, when you're using the staff, you're recognizing that everything you do functions on all levels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's a very powerful position.
I think, too, when you look at that, I'm just going to add to this, if you look at it, it's very Kabbalistic. I mean, the Mick and Mac are the pillars of fortune form, the middle path is the pillar of equilibrium, and there's the four loops on that produces that she holds, which represents the four worlds, in my mind, the upper world being the one that's open into the divine.
Right, well, exactly. I mean, so the symbolism there is very obvious. Shows quite obviously, and also in the classic Kundalini symbolism, the Kundalini has a natural curvature that rises up, so it does cross at the chakra levels. The chakra levels are sort of like intersections, and in the same way as the Tree of Life, you could say that the Sephiroth are like little train stations. and the places between them are little train tracks going between. Well, so much for that. All right, so...
Oh, the illustrations. We're going to have to diagnose these illustrations, too.
Yeah, we will. We'll do that after we... So I guess it's Simon. Who did I say I was going to be Mac? No, Mike?
No, I'm going to be Mac, and I think Val's going to be, I don't know, I guess you're going to be Mike, huh?
Yeah, I'm Mike. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I begin.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I know this card. This
let's
is,
see.
Wait, you have to, let's go, oh, I'm ahead of the game. Go ahead, do the intro, dear.
Darn intro.
This just takes me back to the 60s.
the magic.
I thought Prometheus spoke first. Let's see.
Yeah.
Well, are you reading the
intro?
The intro page.
Yeah, Promethean number 12.
February 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
America's best comics.
Mm-hmm.
The Magic Theater. A pop art happening. Ta-da!
Poetry
and light show.
Okay. Let's see. You two snakes, Mac and Mike, have brought me to this, the theater of the mind, to learn about magic. Am I right?
I'm Mac. I'm Mike. He's Mac. One's front, the other's back. There are the mind's high. Falls, dear child, with golden information tilted. Here is revealed all to see the magic of reality.
Conversely, we may also view reality in magic, too. The universe's starry rash that burst from nowhere in a flash, the magic of this earthly ball, the wonder that we're here at all.
The blazing miracle of thought that all of this emerging from naught to learn of magic is not hard.
Just pick a card. Pick any card.
And then below we see the little neonate of Aleister Crowley.
And the tiles selling Promethea.
Amongst the tiles saying metaphor, Prometheus says, "Oh, I know this card. This is the first of the major tarot cards, card zero, the Fool."
"Indeed, in blithe, uncaring bliss, the Fool steps over a precipice, as if he trusts the winds so chill to bear him wheresoever they will.
Thus any venture is begun, this reckless step from naught to one. It's magic's foremost trick, I guess, how something comes from nothingness.
Like rabbits from an empty hat, or thoughts from nowhere, just like that. From whence, where space and time deploy, if not this empty quantum void?
Was matter pushed, or did it fall to being out of naught at all? What magic shapes the way things fell? The Fool smiles, knows, but does not tell.
We come from mirrors, come from smoke. Aleister Crowley tells a joke, which, if it's understood, they say, will make all magic clear as day.
There were these two men sharing a railway carriage.
Rollaway carriage? Are you sure that's part of the train of thought? And where is all this light suddenly exploding from?
My child, existence has begun. Card zero has become card one. The Fool to the magician yields, and from the vacant quantum field erupts the singularity of all that is, or that may be.
The magus represents the will that made things happen then and still. The male forced the creative urge, the wand from which all actions surge.
The spark from which all things proceed, that which ignites each word, each deed, births cosmos in a sudden storm and conjures all things into form.
He's every artist, scribe, or sage. Tis he that marks the empty page. He is whatever seems a least odd, a big bang or a father god.
Pa Theorem.
They don't know each other. They just happen to be traveling together.
And so the universe commences with this immense male spurt of energy? It's impressive, I'll grant you. But couldn't it all have started by chance? Where does magic come into it?
By chance? One fireburst in the night somehow gets everything just right? The nuclear forces weak and strong? What if the balance had been wrong?
Electromagnetism, too. Or gravity, slightly askew. Would yield a cosmos that lived on, but a moment, then was gone.
No, after that first brilliant spark came countless aeons of fatal dark. Card one, the magus, slides from view, replaced by the priestess. Card two.
Across the abyss, see her sprawl between the many and the all. The stars gestalt in her great night. Then finally, one by one, ignite.
The highest female energy and midwife to all form is she. The universe finds in her ways its secondary inflation phase.
Parent of suns and substance, she. Womb of all possibility. She's mother of all that matters schemes, its aspiration and its dreams.
Maker hope.
One of the men had, resting on his lap, a cardboard box with holes punched in the top.
Then, what you're implying is that all these tarot pictures represent a coded history of everything? The Fool's the initial quantum vacuum? with the magus and priestess as primary and secondary inflation period of what we call the Big Bang? All right. So after that first flash, after the long, dark, silent pause that followed after the stars had finally switched themselves on, then what?
When all suns greeted that first day, the elements, by then in play, were in great gaseous glob flung fog, strewn about every birthing star.
These clouds of matter cooled, congealed, till the planets hung, revealed. Our mother world amongst them, see, here is our empress here, Card 3.
She is all bounty and all love, lovely as Venus, bright above. Earth, water, fire, and air, as one, turn here in fertile union.
The holy spark betwixt he and she burns in her sweet fecundity. The seeds of life in her abide in wind of fire, avalanche, and tide.
How fair is she, our queen, our earth, that sheltered us, that gave us birth? A pert home.
After some time spent contemplating what might be inside his traveling companion's box, the other man at last could not contain his curiosity.
I don't think I can contain my curiosity either. What comes next after the cosmos has organized itself enough to form a planetary system?
What next indeed? The stage is set, but drama can't commence just yet. Our leading man, though unrehearsed, must step into the spotlight first.
The lifeless chemicals and clay must somehow braid to DNA. Card 3's supplanted by Card 4. Behold him, life, the Emperor.
In him a divine energy achieves substantiability.
His double helix scepter twists, conjures all beings from the mist. The rules that govern all life's toils are in his chromosome run coils.
This spiral strand of all who live, this spool genetic narrative, provides the cast who will clown and rage across the new Earth's empty stage.
This twisted rope, life's script, life's scheme, and lends our cosmic play its theme. Rope Sema.
He said, "Excuse me, but I couldn't help noticing your box. Does it by chance contain some variety of animal?"
Variety of animal? Is that connected with the stuff about the emergence of DNA? I'm sorry. I'm having trouble keeping the different threads separate. I'm not even sure which of you two is which.
It's like a fugue. You have a choice of following a single voice or letting each strand grow less clear, the music of the whole to hear.
This talk of threads and interplay returns us to the DNA. Card 4, source of all that's alive, becomes the hierophant. Card 5.
This visionary papal force guides fledgling life upon its course, that the initial spark divine might foster a terrestrial line.
From algae to annelid worm, through evolution's hoop we squirm. From fish to reptile, snake to bird, we're scaled or feathered or else furred.
From monkeys, life adapts and thrives till Homo fabulus habilis arrives. Lucy, a fossil remnant found in some far Ethiopian mound.
A female hominid, this find, was predecessor to mankind. First human print on time's long track.
And since you ask, I'm Mike. He's Mac.
Ape Mother.
The other man, though obviously surprised by this impertinent intrusion from a stranger, smiled politely as he answered,
"I see. After millennia of evolutionary process, we arrive at modern man and woman, just in time for card six, which is called..."
"The lovers. See them neath their tree? Vessels of sacred alchemy. In sex's crucible they stir the red and white, the him and her.
In Eden once they knew sex not, nor death nor any of that lot. Being Anubis they were quite immortal and hermaphrodite."
"That their amoebas is implied by Eve grown from her husband's side."
"So, in a deathless state of grace, they're not much use around the place. The wily serpent DNA brings sex and death here into play.
With these two factors, there can be progress and possibility. Thus do we fall, does Eden end, or in genetic terms, descend.
Unlike Anubis, as their thrive, things now must kill to stay alive. Our animal dilemma's plan. We're either able or we're king."
"Oh well, that's life. Let's leave and trust things to their prehistoric lust, that all our history may proceed from jungle humps, from mammal need. Me atop her."
"He said you're absolutely right. There is indeed a creature kept inside this box."
"Me atop her. I love that one."
Yeah.
So now we're at the point where early man has multiplied and gone forth around tribal hunter-gatherer stage of humankind's development.
Ah, yes. Each huddled a little band, without a scheme and with nothing planned. No pack nor vehicle to convey your species on its destined way.
Nothing to guide them, save the things in their shaman's drugged mutterings, as he goes where the gods abide with vision's chariot to ride.
Or, if the thought offends you less, the higher planes of consciousness, he plumbs uncharted mental spaces, as card 7-6 replaces.
Whilst he rides upwards, see him suck the soul's wine from his holy cup. Ambrosia, nectar, soma, these swill through our myths and history.
Research suggests that all these brews were psychedelic mushroom stews. These magic potions, it appears, perhaps gave Dawn Man big ideas.
Maths, language, art, society, how did such notions come to be? Were they inspired by visions spied upon the shaman's chariot ride?
It seems that in all last result, all culture must arise from cult. The chariot rolls, and as it goes, mankind's route to the future flows.
Oh, mere path.
And furthermore, I may reveal the animal in question is a mongoose.
Then what you're saying is that everything in our culture, including language and art, arose from drugged out insights of the first magicians. I'm not sure I accept that, but even so, for the first societies to grow from tribal cults must have required a period of...
adjustment, or card number 8, formerly justice, is that state of balanced equilibrium, harmony from stern judgment come.
Notions of order, laws emerge to check the swelling yearning surge, when cooperation seems to be our best survival strategy.
In the crude limits she defines, are civilization's first faint line, your species, from its first decree, starts taking itself seriously.
This will bring problems, yes, that's true, but hasten human progress, too. With law, mankind chooses its way, the game that it intends to play.
making society their goal. Your kind at last adopt a role, ambitious, difficult, and meant to show their purposeful intent.
They feel their course, marked in red tape, suits the more serious class of ape.
A pro-theme.
The first man who initiated the inquiry was astonished by this revelation.
The first human? No, hold on. I'm getting a joke mixed up with the stuff about early humanity. So let's see, the first simple laws and taboos have been established, the basic rough prototype of the civilizations that will follow.
Yes, human culture now must wait, needs time to properly gestate, to grow there in the dark and warm, from simple to more complex form.
See him, alone there in the dark, who keeps all light hopes falter and spark. Card 9, the hermit, floats complete in the first cave of that first retreat.
Culture evolves, grows hands, new parts in fertile dark, for history starts. Society drifts, sucks its thumb, and dreams of what it might become.
While in the gloom, there all around, the rhythmic, reassuring sound of history's heartbeat. Hear it ring, destiny's pulse blood quickening.
Hear tempo.
Shuddering with surprise, he sought some further explanation of this certainly provocative disclosure made by his strange fellow traveler.
The hermit as an embryo. Well, I suppose that makes certain sense. And after the social gestation period, I suppose we get the birth of classical civilization, where history as we know it commences.
Aye. Empires rise, then cease to be in the roulette of destiny. Change governs all affairs of men. The Wheel of Fortune, or Card 10.
See Babylon fall. See Egypt thrive. Till Alexander's Greeks arrive, then next the Romans come to town, the wheel turns, we go up, else down.
Stones crack and hanging gardens rot, 'tis only change that changes not. There's one enduring truth to learn, that things will change, the wheel will turn.
Like sulfur, salt, and mercury, three principles of alchemy, one state must to the next give way, caught in the wheel's eternal play.
Yet empires still bemoan their lot as they're churned under and forgot. Oh, time, they cry, and fear the new. But times change. What you gonna do? Ad tempora.
A mongoose? Sir, I must confess I had expected it to be perhaps a cat, a rabbit, not a creature so exotic and outlandish.
I'll admit, it's wonderful how the great cultures arose from scattered tribes, how they produced all that incredible art and writing and philosophy. All the same, classical culture eventually overreached itself.
The heights to which empire aspire are oft brought low by their desire, a moral power unchecked, released. A whole astride a ravening beast.
This then is card 11's thrust. What was called strength is now called lust. Consider the conquest of Rome, while reckless orgies seized at home.
A drunken harlot holds the reign of conquering force none may restrain. Insatiable the concubine rides on, inflamed by victory's wine.
Like wildfire that no man shall tame, she is in us, that hungry flame, that lust, careless of lessons learned wherein we get our fingers burned.
The whims of the Sarah glow, where empire's lions were to go, the success intoxicated, she owns to no vulnerability.
Yet culture creatures that know fear are not so real as those that have forgotten. Rome's power extends, a wanton sprawl, proud strumpet, headed for a fall. O Harris Et.
The animal you mentioned so excites my curiosity that I must beg you, sir, to tell me more. Where are you bound with such a specimen, if I may be so bold?
And where are you two going with this argument, if I may be so bold? You mentioned a proud strumpet headed for a fall. Would that be the fall of Rome and the start of the Dark Ages?
Time's mills do not afore empires stop. Rome's fall was more a gallows.
Card 12, the hangman, seems to mark how light descended, plunged to dark, the hard-won knowledge of mankind to brute barbarian night confined.
True wealth, Buckminster Fuller said, is information in man's head. How, then, may we conceive the cost of culture to the lynch mob lost?
Yet barbarous Norse mythology has Odin hung on gallows tree, so to be made initiate in the last mysteries of fate.
Initiation, it's implied, may be a dark and desperate ride. A journey through the land of shade requires before the progress is made.
Man's dark age, this card may reveal, was but a necessary ordeal. The anesthetic dark you'd need for vital surgery to proceed.
Rome falls, dark comes, all human life and culture goes under the knife. Fate weighs, mankind is hanged yet lives. The medical alternatives.
Operate.
The other man who sat with the perforated box on his lap shrugged wearily as he replied.
Oh dear, well, if the Dark Ages was like a necessarily painful period of surgery for mankind, then the outcome doesn't look good. This is the death card.
What better symbol, grim and bleak, of the Dark Ages at their peak? Or battlefields, the corpse birds keen their paean to death, our card 13.
Though this card sounds a funeral bell, it has another tale to tell. Death, our eventual awful fate, means nothing more than change of state.
One state must end, 'tis common sense, before another may commence. This card permits, then, a fresh view, death of the old that births the new.
Folks' bodies dies, their souls reborn, into the golden solar dawn. So too with culture, man's dark age was but a necessary stage.
With great Constantinople felled, the scholars and the books it held fled west, their knowledge to impart and give the Renaissance its start.
The high dark ages in endless night, field is itself seeds for new light. Tis fear and ignorance that wreathe beneath time's blunt yet powerful seed.
Reap them.
Well, he said, it's something of a personal matter as it concerns a family tragedy.
Well, I guess the Dark Ages were a tragedy for the human family, but no, I'm getting mixed up again. We just about reached the dawn of the Renaissance.
Aye, dawn's the word. The dark clouds part for Renaissance. Card 14. Art.
Formerly, Temperance, she'll spill dreams of silver with the gold of will. Imagination tempered by that part of us most wise, most high.
Will and imagination tied, the keys to all success provide. Silver and gold together bound, bring daydreams down to solid ground.
This chemistry allowed man's fire to rise above the dark age mire. Is in each work of art, each word in every song you ever heard.
Science, art, and beauty rose anew like gods through skies of Sistine blue. Man had survived the dark, dire test, and lights came on across the west.
Consciousness flourished, reason thrived, civilization was revived. Let poets tell it and inspire. Let passion ring from every lyre.
Emote harp.
However, since I'm confident I may rely on discretion, I suppose I don't mind sharing my unfortunate account with you.
I don't understand. If the Renaissance was such a shot in the arm for culture, how come the next card is the devil?
It all depends on what we mean by this, the devil, card 15.
A pentacle surrounds his frown with four parts up and one point down. Four elements of matter rise while spirit downmost trampled lies.
The spirit's world we thus conceal while matter's realm seems all that's real.
Thus Satan offers Christ unfurled the wealth of the material world. The devil is then by and large materialism's fierce mirage.
So, in the light Renaissance brings, the age of reason spreads its wings. The rational now holds full sway, and science ascends as God gives way.
Materialism's steady creep, which William Blake called Newton's sleep, brings worldly blessings, fair and fine, yet blinds mankind to the divine.
Such tempting gifts this devil brings, steam engines, printing, splendid things, that in their wake an age decree of spiritual drudgery. The mop era. I like that one.
You see, the man went on, this sorry tale concerns my elder brother.
So what you're saying is that the Renaissance ushered in the Age of Reason, which replaced spirituality with materialism. I guess that's when the human agenda changed from vague notions of spiritual progress to miserable physical advances.
Quite understandably, we feel the world of the materially real needed to grow and to progress before considering consciousness.
But if not balanced by the soul, materialism's final goal lies in that grim industrial flower shown here in card 16, the tower.
Like Babel, meant to heaven reach all towers, men build a lesson teach. Lightning descends from the sky, reminds man there is but one Most High.
So too, materialism's soar is struck down by the First World War. Its lightning, forked from Europe's skies, arrests the industrial ideals arise.
Its dream, its vision, its great plan of technology serving a man here sours and flounders, ends in blood, in Popeye's wire, Flanders mud.
Industrial society meets here the storm's ferocity. War's lightning tramples underfoot its high-piled cities, wreathed in soot. Metro heat.
He's always been what I suppose you might refer to as the black sheep of the family.
I see. We're up to the 20th century, and the dream of industrial utopia has gone down in the flames of World War I. So what comes after the tower?
All men raise towers that crash and burn and break their hearts, yet never learn so much as when they sprawl amazed amidst the ruins, concussed and gazed.
Thus, o'er the scarred world, racked with harm, is poured the soul's remedial balm. Through mankind's dark, light from afar, as in card 17, the star.
In bloody conflict's aftermath, man yearns for a more sacred path. In a bereaved world or wrecked lives, faith in the occult clearly thrives.
Angels of Mons, Theosophy, the fairies snapped at cotton clay, the golden dawned each magic rite, vague glimpses all of distant light.
Materialism's end, 'twas found in bleached young bones on foreign ground. Tiring of war, maps mankind's led to chart the spectral realm instead.
Occult philosophies define the territory of the divine, plot ghostly starlit coasts, and trace the shifting contours of its face. Map O'Ether.
He has for many years indulged himself in a predictable and commonplace array of vices, of which the worst is his fondness for strong spirits.
Well, I suppose the spiritual resurgence after the war did allow a flicker of light. But the fact that it's represented as a star suggests that it's still tiny and surrounded by blackness.
That dark is in our next card showed. The 20th century's lampless road. Past horrors frightful and obscene. Bit by the moon, our card 18.
This card displays, dark and forlorn, mankind's dark hour before the dawn. Auschwitz, Hiroshima, each blight, each tyranny obscures the light.
This 22-card tarot set matches the Hebrew alphabet. With this moon card attributed, the quote, which means back of the head.
Thus man's unconscious mind's implied, his darker, more unreasoning side. It's the moon's blackest face we see, the underworld of Hecate.
Mankind's long path is fraught with pain. Through the Hecate's nightmare domain, the lethal nuclear stockpiles grow beneath her wing, crepuscular glow.
O'er earth there hangs a cloud of doubt. Might man's light flare, then be snuffed out?
Mankind grows with its end obsessed. The very planet seems depressed.
Earth mope.
His drinking has progressed until he is now in the final melancholy stages of delirium tremens.
I'm starting to understand humanity's every glimmer of spiritual insight seems to eventually deteriorate into darkness and conflict. But then our material situation grows unbearable. That forces mankind towards a spiritual rediscovery as a counter-reaction.
Of course, this rhythm to and fro is part of history's quickening flow. There's darkness, then new days begun, illumined by card 19, the sun.
The Hebrew letter Resh, we find, is to this tarot path assigned. Its meaning, a front of head, is naught but bright, enlightened, conscious thought.
With World War II, factors converge. Wealth, science, a demographic surge. Youth, by the century's middle years, outnumbers age, seeks new ideas.
Buddhism, Zen, astrology, and the I Ching mixed randomly with drugs which aped the shaman's trance into the decade's cultural dance.
This was a psychedelic peak, or soul revealing, from the Greek. Youngsters still wet behind the ears took on the roles of bards or seers.
At last, the Zeitgeist's solar flash scorched most such visionaries to ash. Their lives confused, addicted, lame, drugged melodramas now became
meth opera.
My brother now sees serpents everywhere, which is the reason I am taking him this manga, that he may be rid of them.
You're saying that the explosion of psychedelic consciousness during the 60s was important. However, it ended up, I guess, because it was the largest ever generation, it influenced what came after. For better or for worse, its ideas are still around today.
Ideas mankind will need, one fears, sometime in the next 20 years. To Zen card 20 comes in play, the aeon once called Judgment Day.
Apocalypse, as the world's end seen, need only revelation mean. Our world of ideas set alight by information fierce and bright.
Man's knowledge doubles, it appears, just less than every couple of years. Man's last 2 years more breakthroughs see than all your previous history.
It's said by 2017, it's doubling each half second scene. Here information's flashpoint looms, its blaze reveals as it consumes.
Men judge themselves in this new light. One worldview's crashed, the next takes flight.
One aeon's burned by this knowledge flash, new consciousness born from its ash.
Says Crowley, when not telling jokes, this aeon Harpocrates evokes. World's end is ruled then by his rod, Harpocrates, the silent god. Meet Harpo.
Excuse me, the other man interjected, looking puzzled. But these snakes your brother sees, aren't they imaginary snakes? Indeed, his fellow traveler replied, but this.
Then the world, as we understand it, ends by 2017. What happens next? And if you could remind me, which of you is which again?
We've reached the last card in our pack. I'm Mike, that handsome one. He's back.
A new universe has begun, as shown here in card 21. Add on card 0 and 10 spheres, the 32nd path appears.
This Earth-Moon path shows at a glance a flesh and imagination's dance. The earthly life snake DNA, the Luna dream girls glide and sway.
Mankind moves from the earthly plane to Moon's imaginary domain. Already, work and play take place increasingly in virtual space.
Man's path through the matter's war fields led to this dream realm that awaits ahead, where we may lift our gaze and see overhead the soul's infinity.
Rejoice! This is the promised time of Earth's ascent to realms sublime. Imagination's endless dance is mankind's jeweled inheritance.
Imagination, then, is the key to magic sumptuous territory. Man's verse finds in this moonlight climb its last, most satisfying rhyme.
Heart poem.
And here he gestured meaningfully to the perforated box set in his lap. It is an imaginary mongoose.
Thus does our serpent's tale conclude, or start fresh if you're in the mood. Around and round our fable goes, eternal like Ouroboros.
As for you, listener, dear child, we've led you far through pastures wild. Perhaps we should be getting back. So bye from Mike.
And ciao from Mac. Promethea.
Interesting take on the Major Arcana, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. Fascinating. So, thank you everybody for taking us through this ritual dance. And,
well, that's all right. You're Mike, the handsome one.
Of course. We know who Mac is, the one who lacks. Okay.
I have something on the back of the Absolute, and I don't know if it's in any of the other editions. On the back cover of the Absolute, Promethea holds a panel, and the little Prometheus there too, the cartoon Promethea, the very small one, I forgot her name. And you have a figure shuffling the cards. I don't know if it's Jack Faust or not. And he deals out the cards, and then you have the weeping gorilla holding the cards and says, "I always get the bleeply bleeping cards."
Yes.
And then over the shoulder is another character, and I don't know whether I'd recognize this character. And then he said, and his balloon says, "He's bluffing." Maybe I'll scan this and put it in. I don't know if you have it on your copy.
Yeah, I know it's not on the. It is. I know it's not on the. On this.
Okay, I'll scan it then. I'll just put it and you just put it up on the website, because maybe it's a little clue of something that we don't have with the other editions.
I mean, there are definitely three, or one could say four, storylines going on here. They're all related, but, you know, we've got the Aleister Crowley's biography from conception through his death, when he's on his deathbed. We've got the progress of mankind in the background. We've got the progress of the majors, and we've got the progress, one might say, of the anagrams.
All of the anagrams are variants on Promethea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated. I as a word person, I am absolutely fascinated by the anagrams.
He did use a anagram or a word. There's a program, an anagram creator.
Well, it's still cool. It's just cool.
Yeah.
I mean, he does spell metaphor with an E on the end, which is not technically correct, but mm-hmm. he does use, all of the letters, so it is an anagram. So,
what I found fascinating here, between adjustment and hermit card, he has the, the opening of the circle, the opening...
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And... which is interesting.
Well, if we have the patience to go through this, what I thought we should probably do is describe the pictures. And for one thing, let's talk about one thread specifically, which is the easiest one to grasp. If you go to the PDF file. I have the source. Well, actually, it's also in your email. Email I sent you. There's the I included in the bottom of that thing the Aleister Crowley story anecdote.
You know what? I don't think I got the
magic of theory and practice. Well,
I didn't get the email this week.
You didn't get it?
No, I didn't.
I sent it out last night. You should have gotten it.
No,
I didn't get one either. I haven't got one for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, okay. I did not get one.
Huh. Well, I'll send it again. As soon as the class is over, I'll resend it, but... let me read it to you. This is from Aleister Crowley, Magic and Theory and Practice. By the way, there was an attachment to this email that maybe why you didn't get it, which was a story, a PDF story from H.G. Wells called The Apple, which I wanted you to read in conjunction to this anecdote there are two levels of imagination that have to do with materialism. So I wanted you to read that. I wanted you to have that under your. I wanted you to have read that one too. So there is the story of the American in the train who saw another American carrying a basket of unusual shape. His curiosity mastered him, and he leant across and said, "Say, stranger, what you got in the bag?" The other lantern-jawed and taciturn replied, "Mongoose." The first man was rather baffled, as he'd never heard of a mongoose. After a pause, he pursued the risk of a rebuff and said, "But say, what is a mongoose?" "Mongoose eats snakes," replied the other. This was another poser, but he pursued, "What in hell do you want a mongoose for?" "Well, you see," said the second man in a confidential whisper, "my brother sees snakes." And the first man was more puzzled than ever, but after a long think, he continued rather pathetically, "But, say, them ain't real snakes." "Sure," said the man with the basket, "but this mongoose ain't real either." Here's a little. This is a perfect parable of magic. There is no such thing as truth in the perceptible universe. Every idea, when analyzed, is found to contain a contradiction. It is quite useless, except as a temporary expedient, to set up one class of ideas against another for being more real. The advance of man towards God is not necessarily an advance towards truth. All philosophical systems have crumbled, but each class of ideas poses true relations within itself. So that's the original version. In some ways, I think if we just read the thread of the story through without the thing, his is a little more the way that Alan Moore retells it makes it a little clearer, because he emphasizes that the guy's unreal snakes is from being an alcoholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that's not emphasized in the way that Crawley writes the joke.
I would like to interject something. Those tiles with the human figure, the ceremonial magic tiles, that's the ending, the completion of casting a circle, or it's a sign of the morning Isis, sign of Osiris risen, sign of Apophis and Typhon, LVX. Those are the between Adjustment and the Hermit.
Between Adjustment and the Hermit.
Yeah.
What was the page you're talking about?
As above, so below. You see the figures? There's tiles. There's multicolored tiles running across.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a human figure.
Right, right.
As above, so below. Then it's sign of the morning Isis, sign of Apophis and Typhon, sign of Osiris risen, LVX.
Right. And those are pictures from Crawley's equinox.
Mm-hmm.
Of him showing the positions that you take in this revelation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the whole thing, the sign of the Osiris risen is the Christ. With, you know, the transformation, you know, the resurrection, the potentiality.
Yeah, it's actually, there are these 10 cards, and it's interesting if we related the 10 cards to the first major arcane.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that the first one is definitely the magician, as above, so below.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then the second card would obviously, which is the one that talks about the first man who's initiated the inquiry was astonished by this revelation, is the high priestess.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, both arms seem to be outstretched and then bent at the elbows and being held up. That's the way I see that. And then the third card, which is the Empress, that looks like the hands are put inside the pockets.
Or, no, I think they're fingers.
No, they're the fingers with the triangle, making a triangle going down.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Yes, all right. I see that. All right. That's good. Okay, I'm glad we're clarifying this, because otherwise we wouldn't see it. Then number four.
Number four is bringing it up to the head, a triangle up to the head. So that's the emperor. That's the fire triangle.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like at the eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then number five, which is...
the opening. It's the opening of the portal. And then...
Number six, which is the lovers. In this case, he's actually turns. He turns to the left, it looks like. He turns to the right on his side.
I think he's still facing forward. I see both of his feet facing
forward. Both of his feet facing forward. And he has his hands up towards the brace. Oh, I got to one show. Looks like one hand over the other. One arm over the other.
Like crossed over, almost like the Two of Swords in the Rider-Waite-Smith deck.
And then,
That's me atop her, everybody.
Okay, whatever.
And I remember that. The only one.
You're never going to forget that either, I think.
Okay. It's open at his heart level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then number seven. He seems to be holding his arms outstretched like he's about to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you see how his feet seem to be very close together here.
Right.
His feet are all close together on all of these.
Except for the next one.
Except for the next one, yeah. And he's and in this case, he's doing a as above, so below.
Yeah, that's LVX.
In this particular case, there's a definite imbalance, and he's definitely... favoring in a way the below.
Mm-hmm. And he's standing on one foot, it appears, on his left foot.
Yeah.
Yeah, where in the Golden Dawn, it's not done that way.
Uh-huh.
It's done with a total L and not favoring to the left. You're straightforward.
I think part of what Crawley's magic is about, though, this is open to correction, is he was really into redeeming matter. That matter was to be redeemed as spirit. And so a lot of his issues on lust and the dark side wasn't so much a revelation of in the dark side as it was a recognition that it had to be redeemed, it had to be brought into the light. That was the purpose of magic in a way. That's one of the reasons why he emphasized that. And then number nine, he's
that's the V.
Arms up and and I guess that would be sort of like the salutation and the, like the welcoming of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And then number ten is completion and closure in a way.
Mm-hmm. Accept the energy within the magician.
In other words, and actually, if you look at the light issues, the backlight issues as seen revealed in these illustrations too.
Mm-hmm.
We have that. So what I'd like to do is proceed in a slightly orderly fashion, starting with the first page, which is based on the famous psychedelic art of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in which we have Mick and Mike, and we also have the the ego, the flame, the flight of the eagle aspects as an extension both of flame and of feather of the central pillar, which emphasizes its transcendence of the caduceus, and obviously the wings here are important. So
well, I am going to have to leave. Thank you all very much, and I will listen to the rest of this on the recording when I get back.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Mary Beth has left the conference.
Shall we... So what's some of the associations one has with wings?
Well, I think clarity. It's clarity. I think it goes along with the Swords card in my mind. I mean, the clarity. The whole thing with me on this spread. I think the arc of the influence is really important in the spread here today.
All right.
Well, I want to kind of keep us on the same page, David. I want to discuss a little bit about the caduceus symbolism, and then if we want, then we could bring into the. If we want to talk about the reading, let's do that.
Well, what I said a minute ago, I think wings correlate to swords. And swords go along with clarity. And the thing is, she's bringing clarity to the whole storyline in this particular situation.
But back to the question. The question is what is the symbology of wings?
Well, the whole thing to rise above.
I would have with wings.
Yeah, I think of wings as rising above, the ability to rise above. It's a natural ability given by nature.
Yeah, one of the things that wings do is they make the wind a path. In other words, normally the wind goes hither and yon,
mm-hmm.
and we don't know what it is. But if we have wings, we're able to use the wind to make it our pathway. In other
mm-hmm.
words, make it an element of locomotion. It's a way of harnessing the wind to our own thing. And in that sense, it definitely. And of course, wind is spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that what we're able to do is we're able to harness the spiritual force of things through the use of wings. So that, let's take a little while and look at the reading that we did. And I guess...
I want to make a statement here. On her right leg... is a tattoo of Anubis.
No, that's not Anubis, that's Thoth.
Thoth, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thoth Hermes, right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. That's cute.
Yeah.
I should get a picture of Thoth Hermes on me. I've always been resistant to tattoos. But I think a nice Thoth tattoo would be just the right thing. Over my heart, I guess, would be a good place to put it. Have that little bird eating my heart.
Yeah, right.
A little bird-headed wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Do you want to cover the spread now?
Let's
get that on recording. Yeah.
Then the first one is the priestess. That's Yodfire,
mm-hmm.
priestess. The second place is He, water, and it's the three of discs, works. And the third one, Va, air, is the five of discs, worry. And the fourth one, He, earth, is six of swords, science. And the hidden motivation is the, which is below, is the nine of wands, strength. And six above, the future outcome, is the ten of discs, wealth. The arc of influence is, number seven is the magus. Number eight is the six of cups, pleasure. And number nine is fortune. So that's our reading for today. We'll do another reading next week, since we're going to do this chapter twice, probably. The it'll be interesting to compare the two.
Well, when I look at that spread, it kind of goes along with the whole storyline. The whole storyline. The High Priestess is about the mysteries, all right?
Right.
And this is about the mysteries of the tarot, the 22 cards in the tarot.
Right.
And we're going to spend some time working at this storyline in this passage. And then we go into the period of the Dark Ages, which is worry. And we move into the period of science and clarity, which is the age of reason. We move into strength and the flame of the spirit, which is a new change, a new beginning in a way. We're leaving the past behind and moving into the materialism, but it's a different point of view. And from that, we're working with wealth right now. We're in that stage of wealth.
Well, I'm glad you are.
Well, you know, that's where we are in the world. That's where we are in the world, for the most part. For those who have.
Right. And then, of course, what influences that is the Magus, Six of Cups, pleasure and fortune.
You know, what I'm picking up from the reading is that Promethea is now truly the High Priestess. She has integrated the physical reality of her, the Promethea, to her Sophie and things like that. That there's little distinction between the two.
Yeah,
now,
and she's being initiated into this, into the staff, and the staff is the integration of all the elements into through the all four worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So and. The interesting thing is that the High Priestess is usually silent. So one of the things that we could say is that a lot of what we're actually getting here in this story is stuff that, you know, quote, not talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can be getting some truly interesting esoteric ideas, and the anecdote of Aleister Crowley. And his, particularly his little thing at the end, but yeah, we have the punchline where the mongoose isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
Unreal mongoose can get rid of unreal snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Is also saying that there is no, and then he goes on. This is a perfect parable of magic. There is no such thing as truth in the perceptible universe. Every idea, when analyzed, is found to contain a contradiction. It is quite useless, except as a temporary expedient to set up one class of ideas against another as being more real. The advance of man towards God is not necessarily advanced towards truth. All philosophical systems have crumbled, but each class of ideas possesses true relations within itself. So in some ways, what he's saying there about ideas and truth is he's talking about the discrete elements. You know, this is seeing the world through the classic magical implements, you know, which complement and also cancel each other out.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have with the staff is we have a way that they're all integrated, ultimately to the purpose of will, but in this case the will of the higher will of love and of manifestation, but as the perfect human being who is the priestess. So aspire as the priestess is a search will to know to in this profound sense of mystical knowledge of the world. And the next one is, which is in the position of water, is the Three of Discs works. So in some ways, you can see that with the predominance of discs here, this is part of the sort of the redemption of matter theme is going on here. At least that's the way I'm tending to read this.
You know, at the same time, Paul, you say the Three of Discs, which is an earth card, it's mixing up with there, which is going to kind of make things a little on the muddy side.
That's
not clear. And that's what was going on in that storyline. Things weren't clear.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. also, and that continues with the, so we not only have mud, but we also got, spray in the five of discs working.
Mm-hmm.
The air. Yeah, things are really stirred up there.
Right.
Well, you know, when you, the five of discs is really at the bottom of the Wheel of Fortune, it's the nadir.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the Six of Swords science, right, which is air again, and the
Earth. Oh, Six of Swords, air being
yeah,
in
yeah, well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The
sorry.
Swords are air, but the Earth is where it is.
Yeah, right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, we can see how you know, we really are talking about, you know, in the muck of. You know, this is a version or a vision of the redemption of the world, or attempted a redemption of the world.
Right, science. As
hey, guys, I just want to point something out. I'm looking at a deck with the astrological symbols
right.
on it,
mm-hmm.
which I'm trying to learn right now, all those correspondences. But the Five of Discs is Mercury in Taurus. The Six of Swords is Mercury in Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ten of Discs is Mercury and I can't. Who is the other sign?
That's Virgo.
Is it in Virgo?
Virgo or it's Scorpio?
Like so tiny, I can't see it.
Yeah, wait.
It.
It's Virgo.
Okay.
MP. It's an MP. It's like
yeah,
an
MP. Well, this will be an Earth sign anyway, so Virgo makes sense. So yeah, we've got, and of course, the magician is Mercury. So we've got four instances of Mercury in this nine-card spread.
Really?
So that's the whole issue of communication, which is the Mick and Mac function.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, and furthermore, Paul, to follow up on what you were saying earlier, the Caduceus is the symbol of Mercury, and Mercury was one of the only gods that could travel between the worlds. He could travel from Olympus to Earth to Hades and back. He's the only one that had the ability to travel between those different kingdoms.
Yeah, he sort of had the carte blanche. He had an omnibusman pass.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Also, the tattoo of the right leg is Hermes Trismegistus, which is Mercury. Talk.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah, well, actually, in that, yeah, the tattoo, we're still on that first picture here. And we basically have, I think, this is their version of the back of the card, which is the sun. Now, obviously, this is not the Toth Tarot. They didn't use the Toth Tarot for the major arcana. It looks like, does anyone know, looking at that which Tarot they may have adapted? Major Arcana. It looks like they adapted one of those playful.
I don't know. For some reason, it looks like the Hoi Polloi deck.
Something like that. Yeah, you know, it does look like it's an adaption of one of those playful decks that was done back in the 70s or.
Because I have to go on my mark on it here. Okay, I'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Alrighty. Take care, David.
Bye, David.
Wonderful, David.
Has left the conference.
So that might be, if anybody who's, I guess I could look seriously at my encyclopedia of Tarot and see if they're.
Yeah, well, I'm looking it up on Mozilla, Hoi Polloi
yeah.
deck. The also, what's so interesting about the wealth card is it's also considered, I mean, the Golden Dawn, I know we shouldn't go through systems, but I always think of wealth, that wealth card as inheritance. One of the other views of the Ten of Pentacles, right,
yeah.
is inheritance. What you inherit.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's obviously, in some ways, makes more sense here as inheritance than it does, you know, because, you know, this is what we've inherited. We've inherited this sort of breakdown of materialism and, you know, but we haven't really really moved beyond the materialism, obviously.
No, it's not the hoi polloi book. Okay, sorry.
As our political.
Mm-hmm. And also what's going on in the Gulf now with the science can do a lot of destruction.
Sure. Yeah.
And you inherit whatever you create.
And we've been told by grade B science movies ever since the 50s, not before, the mad scientist is perpetual.
Mm-hmm.
A perpetual, almost an independent archetype at this point. But
and shortcuts don't work.
So let's move to the next page, which is where the baby's born. We have two little characters that are on opposite pages that we haven't mentioned verbally yet. One is the little devil,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is the little angel.
Yeah.
And I don't think they necessarily represent Mick and Mac particularly. They're not necessarily related to those, but we do have this. They do appear pretty much in all the pages.
Mm-hmm.
In varying places. Without making a commentary, but in some ways you do see here that one of the things that's going on and one of the functions of metaphor, what classically is a metaphor?
It's an allusion to something else.
Yeah, exactly. So what's inherent in the idea of metaphor? The inherent in the idea of metaphor is that there is an underlying duality that you see through or you alter
mm-hmm.
by putting them together. And by putting two things that seem desperate together, you get an insight into the thing you're talking about. You know, metaphor is sometimes considered in linguistics, but also in science and in semantics, is the principal way that we know everything. All knowledge is metaphoric,
mm-hmm.
which in some ways also means that it's that all knowledge is transformational, and that works. So kinds of metaphors are analogies. Analogy is a metaphor which is sort of like a trained horse. You know, pure metaphors are like wild horses. And you find them and you discover them and they go, wow. And then they rush off. They rush off with a herd. And whereas, an analogy that's in place, of which we have many, is a trained horse that we can get to, as it were, repeat the trick over and over again. and so that it seems to be more stable. The analogies seem more stable. And then from that we can build on other kinds of transformations, all of which we're always looking for kind of stability. Aristotle's law of identity, which I'm so down on for reasons of reasons of understanding the power of symbolism, is A equals A, right? Mm. Which is an attempt in some ways to create the most stable of metaphors. A rose is a rose. That's it. And then the idea is to assume that this law of identity is the same for ideas as it is for things. It's sort of like saying, which is a metaphor. Ideas and things are similar. That's a metaphor. But we know that things are things, right? But ideas aren't things. And selves are not things. So if we think of ourself as a thing, we think of it as having this sort of indivisible or individual sameness, the way a rock is a rock is a rock. So a self is a self is a self. It has this persistence of sameness. But what's fascinating is that's not, selves are not things.
Mm-hmm.
Selves are permeable. So that the law of identity is a cheat when it comes to identity in the sense of trying to make selves identification into things, or A equals A, because actually what A equals, being an identification, can equal a range of things. You know, so in other words, it equals A equals A, B, C, D, E, F, G in an array or in a pattern. You know, all of which are metaphors, and they're all wild. You know, they're
mm-hmm.
like the herd running through, and you catch bits and pieces of them, but they're untamable. And of course, that's both their magical strength. You know, in the same way that primary speech is naturally metaphoric, and abstract speech, which is abstract and so forth, is tends to use analogies, and even more so, it tends to use just laws of identity, so that you know arose, so that things are things, in ways that are kind of staid and almost trite, and removed from you know the visual field and play of experience. All right, I guess I don't want to go off into Never Never Land here.
You love your metaphors.
This is important. Well, I am in the fool, right? So I'm just expressing my foolishness here. So there are two men sharing, and I want to take some of these analogies very strong here. This is why I want to spend a couple of weeks on this chapter. We have on this page, this is the metaphor page. There were two men sharing a railroad carriage. Think of that now as a metaphor. Right? You have a train.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. The train being what? Life? The path?
Yeah. It's
the road of life.
And there are two men, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
And they're both. And of course, in the other thing, they're both Americans, right? So in some ways, they're similar and they're different.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And you know, and so they're sharing. So they are the metaphor. The whole metaphor are these two guys who represent you know, almost Mick and Mac in a way.
Mm-hmm.
They represent two sides to this thing.
Yes.
And then we have the fool. Let's be fair. We have Promethea. Yeah, who is very Sophie-like in this in her
commentary.
Right. Now, she's a real good student. She's paying attention to stuff, and she's going there. And we have at the bottom of the page, we have the baby being born, and in there is the little devil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the kitty corner, up to the opposite page, putting the two pages together with the magus, we have on the cape of Promethea, the little cherub with the thing. So we're looking both at the Magnus and the Fool here. And we have, and then we have the dialogue going on here of Mick and Mac, which to look at closely would actually pay to reread it here. How about, instead of me reading it, since I did already before, why don't somebody else read Mick and Mac here? Just on the fool side of the page.
Let's see here. Fool side of the page, Mick and Mac. Joy, are you still here?
I'm still here, and I ordered the books from the library, but I didn't go and pick them up yet.
Oh, okay.
The library opens at noon today. I'm sorry, I'm a loser.
Oh, don't never say that.
But I'll have them.
No, don't say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. Okay. You want me to read?
You want to read one of these?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. It's that H, the font they use for the H, what was throwing me when I tried to read this earlier.
Oh.
That's what I meant by when I said it was hard to read. It was that little H that kept.
Yeah, I hear you.
Bad.
Yeah. Okay, so starting with Mike, the pretty one. How about you, Val? You can be the pretty one.
I can be the pretty one? Okay.
That's great.
Indeed, in blithe, uncaring bliss, the solstice over purposes. And as if you trust the wind so chill to bear them where, soever they will.
Okay, now, that's a simple little rhyme, but there is a metaphor there. Does somebody want to say what the metaphor is? There's a couple of them, actually.
Stepping off the cliff?
Yeah, the cliff.
Could be a metaphor
one.
For...
The wind?
Mm. The wind, like the wings we were talking about before in the Caduceus?
Yeah, yeah.
The and path of the wind.
And we have this guy, he's sort of... You know, sort of egg-headed guy walking off the cliff, holding onto his balloon, watching the butterfly. But, of course, a butterfly is a transformation of wing.
Right, the winged creature. And he's dependent, he thinks the balloon's going to carry him through. The balloon is his illusions?
Yeah, or in the same way that you could say, and that's an interesting way of looking at it, because normally what you had is you had the knapsack on a stick, you know, which could be, you know, a version of
all
the
fun, right.
With the elements. Usually they, you know, people say, well, what's inside the knapsack? And, oh, it's the elements all rolled up in one. And so you can see there that you have a sort of precipial caduceus, which has now been turned into a balloon in this playful image. And of course, you have the yapping dog,
which he's totally ignoring.
Yeah, and then the next reading the red balloon, Johanna, you want to read the red balloon?
Thus, any venture is begun. This reckless step from naught is one to one. It's magic foremost trick, I guess, how something comes from nothingness.
Yes. You know, and this is a... so here again we have a very interesting metaphor. And it... But the thing I would want to emphasize here is some people are sort of quick to say that what it's saying is literally what it's saying. That, you know, that something comes out of nothing. But that's probably a blind.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a variety of ways, there's a variety of reasons that I would say that it's probably a blind. Yes, there is a metaphor there. But if we look at the full joke of the Aleister Crowley thing, about how you have this the idea of magic where you have, you know, the non-existent mongoose chasing away the non-existent snakes. And that's being the issue of magic. It might be that, I guess, how nothingness, how from nothingness, comes something.
Well, you know what's so interesting also is that the man with the box with the holes is there perceiving. He's initiating a perception for his crazy brother. And
right.
so that he is totally serious, and he knows that this perception will take hold because he believes in it too.
Yeah, yeah, he believes in the box, and he and what he believes, and he's going to tell his brother with great conviction that in there is a mongoose that's going to get rid of his snake.
Which also speaks of the power of thought form and perception.
Yeah, yeah. And if we continue reading, Val, you want to go with rabbits?
Rabbits, okay.
Like rabbits from an empty hat, or thoughts from nowhere, just like that. From whence or space and time deployed, if not just empty quantum void.
So what's nice about Moore is that he is well educated, reasonably. And, he recognizes that partly what we're talking about here is the difference between, you could say the two emptinesses. You have the big emptiness and the little emptiness. And they're not the same. They seem to be the same, but they may be very different. Johanna, you want to read the matter?
The matter. Was matter pushed, or did it fall, to being out of naught at all? What magic shaped the way things fell? The fool smiles, knows, but does not tell.
Okay, and then Val, the last Mick and Mac riddle there.
We come from mirrors, come from smoke. Alistair Crowley tells a joke. Which, if it's understood, they say, will make all magic clear as day.
So that means it does make sense to pay it, to give some thought to that, to this joke, and think about it for the week.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Until our minds go bleak. I'm going to start rhyming now.
Now? Oh, boy.
Oh, God. Save me from my...
Okay, what I'm going to do is put down Promethea 12, reading 1, because we're going to go over this chapter again.
That's right.
Okay, yeah. So that's what
I'm going to... I'm going to send out the email to you guys again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get it, I want to know.
Okay.
Because you should have gotten it. I sent it out yesterday, and it may be that it may be that with the attachment, it wouldn't.
Sent attachments before, and I've always gotten them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a big attachment either. It's just a little 3 or 4 page story. I would like you to read this little story. It's a short story by. Mm-hmm. H.G. Wells. And Wells does represent sort of the opposite of Crowley. So you have Crowley's story, which deserves close attention, and then you have the Wells story, both of which deal with magic and revelation, but at very different levels.
Hmm.
What'd you say the title was on the Wells? Apple?
Yeah, The Apple. Yeah.
The Apple? Okay.
If you Google The Apple, H.G. Wells, There's a place that has short stories collected, and they'll take you right to a PDF of that.
Okay,
short story.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I was
going
to Google it.
Yeah. The boy, did we run out of time quickly?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to spend more than 2 weeks on this chapter, but if we have to, we should. Because I think there are obviously things. You can see here that the issue here of the issue of the fool changing into the magus is a big deal, and it's even brought up in the text itself. Was matter pushed or did it fall to bring naught at all? What magic shaped the way things fell? The fool smiles but does not tell. And then, of course, we move on to the magus. And in some ways, we need to sort of take the Fool and the Magus as twins. And why child existence begins. Card zero has become card one. You know, which is a magic show. In other words, all of a sudden, existence is the magic show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fool to the magician yields from a vacant quantum field, erupts the singularity of all that is, or that may be. And then it goes on, the magus represents the will, and the will, of course, being the fire. Which makes things happen, and then still the male force, the creative urge, the wand which all actions surge. But also the issue here is this will is also the will of love, and I usually make it more hermaphrodite than I do making it particularly masculine.
Mm-hmm.
The spark from which all things proceed, which ignites each word, each deed, birth cosmos to a sudden storm, and conjures all things into form. Every artist's grade, sage, he marks the empty page. He is whatever seems least odd, the Big Bang or the Father God.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know each other. They just happened to be traveling together. So who is, this is Crowley saying they didn't know each other. Who doesn't know each other? Is it the magician and the fool that don't know each other? You know, does the magician know the fool? Does the fool know the magician? And if they don't know each other because they're, you know, twins that, you know, mirror image,
mm-hmm.
as the fool says on Smoke, then who is it that might recognize how they are, as it were, twins?
Okay, but remember, the thing is, which is very, you know, the fool is zero and it could be placed anywhere.
Right.
In the makeup of the major arcana.
Right, right.
So yeah, I think he is...
floating fool.
The floating fool is right. He floats and he exists within the matrix in different areas. It's like the mutant DNA that comes about and brings about some great things.
Yeah.
An evolutionary process, whether it's resistance to disease or genius or something not so nice.
Well, you know what? Some time back, Cynthia sent out a little PDF file, which was Carol Heitzer's analysis of the major arcana by numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically, they're all basically mandalas.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the fool's journey, which is the sevenfold, you know, three paths, or you could say the three pillar version of it. There's also a twofold version of it, which starts, you know, with the perhaps you can number it with the fool, or you can hold the fool and the world card out, and you put all the numbers together. And then there's a variety of mandalas.
Mm-hmm.
This is looking at all the major arcana together. And putting them together numerologically in a variety of different ways, and looking at the patterns and the interrelationships of the major arcana cards. Well, I've been doing it myself lately in the last week or two. I've been looking at natural mandalas from the structure of the tarot deck. And it does really make sense to... you know, spend time, what I call, like, reading these natural structural patterns within the thing, one of which is using the numerology of the deck, so that, you know, you put together the one card, you know, the one, the ten, and the, sun card are all together, you know, sort of like the birth cards. where you have the various cards together in a variety of fashions based on their numerological reduction. I think that keeping those kind of mandalas in faction, particularly when we're looking at this chapter, might give us a way of playing around with the magic of it. So, I guess in parting, I'd like to say, let's definitely pay attention to this Aleister Crowley anecdote, this little joke he tells, and we'll start our discussion next week with that story again and bringing it out. Anything anybody else wants to say in closing?
No, I was going to say something, but if the fool is the idea, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If the fool is the idea, then and the rest of the cards are the action or actions. Oh, this is what I want to say. When I mentioned that about the fool, the DNA type of structure, in very interesting, in the Nile Valley, wheat was very sacred, as we know, you know, the cats guarding the wheat bins and everything like that. But why it was so sacred is because it wasn't sustainable. It took, for some reason, something happened that caused the DNA structure of wheat to change. And I know there's the scientific backup on this, and that had propagated mankind.
Mm-hmm. And well, the other thing too is, in Egypt too, is we have the periodic inundation of the Nile. In other words, the flooding season,
mm-hmm.
which happened pretty much like clockwork. But of course, it was based on the rains that Lake Victoria was taking in,
mm-hmm.
and then the floods that were coming out of it from there.
Right. And which I always found fascinating, that civilization could not have been built without this mutation of the wheat aspect. Joy, you hear that?
I vaguely remember reading something about
that. The Ascent of Man, they reported it as being one of the great...
When I was reading my anthropology stuff,
mm-hmm.
Mesolithic innovations and stuff, they did talk about this genetic change in wheat and corn, as they call it, in the Middle East. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. I guess it's Val and Joy and Johanna and myself are left here. And next week we will return to this because, as I said, I think there's a lot more in here that...
Yeah, it's chock-filled with information. And I'm just making notes as we're talking and back cover. I have to do the back cover.
This is the longest chapter we've had, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of text in the chapter, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
To read through it.
It sort of comes out of the blue in a way. It literally comes out of the blue. Like, all of a sudden, you're there. And here I am thinking, right, of, wouldn't it be great, Promethea as a movie? And then I could see why they never picked it up as a movie, because of this chapter.
Well, not only this chapter, all the chapters coming next.
Mm-hmm.
This is the real kickoff of the, everything has been in a lot of ways has been sort of comic book prelude to now we're getting mm-hmm. down to the nitty gritty.
Uh-huh. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is, if people have stayed away, this is the time to join.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. we're going to get down to. But yeah, but you kind of need the background too about who Prometheus is,
right? And why it's so fascinating that she comes to terms, right?
Important.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so thanks everybody, and we will be here next week. And hopefully it won't be 105 out.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Is it that warm by you?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
It's overcast over here. The sun's not out on the East Coast, but I'm by the water, so.
Yeah, so you're not gonna be that. Probably might be in the 80s or 90s where you are. Yeah,
well, they say about 90s in west of the city and inland in New Jersey. So New Jersey and you pass inland New Jersey, it's going to be very warm.
Yeah, usually probably have about a 10 or 15 degree.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's one of the joys.
You get fog, yeah.
Yeah.
See, in San Francisco, we always get this fog coming in that knocks it down to about 50.
Yeah, right, right.
All right, so
okay.
Take care, everybody.
Okay, I'm going to end the recording now. Anyone want to say anything? Okay.
Nope.
Okay.